From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, what to expect in an unexpected rental housing market.
I think June is going to be a real test for the market because it'll be harder for people to pay, and they're going to prioritize food and medicine and healthcare.
This in a Michigan market already devastated by foreclosures. Also, the state's chief medical officer on the latest infection figures and related issues.
What this pandemic has really shown is that our data systems, our technology systems, are not what they need to be. And public health, quite frankly, has not been funded appropriately for decades.
And why one music professor took students on a massive pre-COVID road trip through the national parks before recording park-inspired music.
Their individual experiences with the environment and with these spaces would help convey that diverseness, that vastness of the parks.
Those stories and more just ahead. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later this hour, we'll speak with the state's top doctor, Dr. Joanne Khaldun, about Michigan's progress on containing the coronavirus outbreak and its capacity to stay the course as the economy begins to reopen. But first, the statewide eviction moratorium expires this Friday. While a district court in Detroit has extended its ban to the end of the month, the COVID-19 crisis is far from over, and that leaves many renters across the state whose jobs have been impacted by the pandemic in a tough spot. What will this mean for people's ability to find and keep a roof over their heads? To help us answer that question, we turn to Mark Norman. He's an associate professor at the University of Michigan's Taubman College of Architecture and Urban Planning. Mark Norman, welcome to Stateside.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Could you start out by just briefing us on the kind of affordability issues that Michigan faces?
Well, it's very different in different places. I mean, in general, Michigan is relatively affordable compared to other places in the country. But I think because of one, low wages and just the kind of housing supplies we have, housing can be a real burden for a lot of people. So when you look at cities like Detroit, a lot of the issues are around the housing supply and also just the relatively low wages of workers in Detroit. In other places like Grand Rapids and Ann Arbor, I would say that the issue really is about supply and just the high incomes that make housing difficult to find for lower income and middle income people.
Would you say that the issues in Michigan's housing market have gone through sea changes because of COVID-19 or just intensified?
I mean, I think we are seeing what's going to happen now, but it's not really clear. You know, unemployment is spiking, but you know, with lockdown only about a month and a half in, people still have some savings and they've been paying their rent. I think June is going to be a real test for the market because it'll be harder for people to pay and they're going to prioritize things like food and medicine and healthcare over housing. And there's some supports against evictions right now that will help them with that, but those are temporary.
So folks might remember that back in March, Governor Whitmer signed an executive order to stop evictions in Michigan during the COVID-19 emergency. Can you recap what that covers and when it comes to an end?
Yeah, so it's temporary. And it basically is a moratorium on evictions. And so that basically means that government action won't be taken for things like a non-payment of rent. But in the longer term, you know, when that moratorium expires, we'll go back to what we had before, which is already pre-COVID, a foreclosure crisis,
and
especially
when,
in cities like Detroit.
When we say when it expires, at this point, that's May 15th.
Right. You know, people are calling for federal action because it's pretty piecemeal now. So, for example, even in cities in Michigan, cities could enact moratoriums. And so I think people are trying to fight for a more comprehensive federal action on these issues.
Should we look to prior economic crashes for guidance on what to do or possibly what not to do?
I would say what not to do. I mean, I think there are a number of cities in Michigan that are still suffering the effects of the 2008 financial crisis, especially around issues like foreclosures, tax seizures, evictions. And we probably could have had a moratorium then, which would have helped a lot of people. We didn't. So I think in one sense, having at least even a temporary moratorium now is better than what we had then. But I think we need to start thinking about the looming eviction crisis we'll have when these moratoriums are lifted.
What was the thinking behind what happened and what didn't happen during the financial crisis? My understanding is that there was at least recognition that some semblance of local government systems was important to preserve during that time, and maybe also government revenue. But what were the drivers that affected the way that got set up?
Well, it's a different case because I would say you could actually point to a villain in the 2008 crisis, right? It was like sort of the decisions on lending made by banks. It was the rampant speculation in mortgage and housing markets. So there were some specific things we could point to and ways we could alleviate it. I think this crisis is so multifaceted, right? State budgets are suffering. We can't really point to a culprit other than the virus itself. So it exacerbates our existing problems, but we can't necessarily point to one actor or one sort of sector for relief. And I think that's the hard part here.
Right. There have been some tenant unions in Michigan who've been exploring the possibility of rent strikes. What effect do you think that might have on the markets if we saw rent strikes in either, in either a micro way or on a more widespread basis?
I mean, rent strikes really, historically, are to gain attention for an issue and to try to spur change. But rent strikes aren't going to necessarily solve any problems. I mean, housing is a supply chain like anything else, right? Like food or like manufacturing. And so withholding rent means that income doesn't go to, you know, cleaning staff, maintenance, or to the owners that might have mortgages. So it won't necessarily have a positive impact unless it actually changes policy. So it's a kind of symbolic thing that you could do, but it doesn't necessarily help the larger issue, and it might actually hurt the issue more.
Are there ways to intervene in the crisis that's happening right now without bringing to a halt all the other mechanisms in the financial system? As you've alluded to, I mean, property owners have mortgages as well, and they have banks that they have to answer to.
Yeah. There's a bill that was introduced by Representative Ilhan Omar, and it's co-sponsored by our Michigan representative, Rashida Tlaib, to cancel rent and mortgage payments. I don't know its chances in the House, and certainly I don't know its chances in the Senate, but that was a bill to sort of acknowledge the looming crisis and to think forward to sort of how we deal with this. And so I think, you know, legislatively on the federal level, people are trying to create solutions to this. We also have the CARES Act, mm-hmm. Which was actually passed, and that puts in place...
That's the Coronavirus Aid Relief and Economic Security Act for those at home on their scorecards.
Thank you.
Yeah.
But that, once again, is temporary, and it's where the federal government can intervene, which is with federally backed mortgages. You know, otherwise...
And just to explain, it stops a class of landlords from filing new eviction cases for non-payment of rent starting March 27th and continuing to July 24th.
Correct. But, you know, that can only happen with places where there is a federal touch on the mortgage or on the housing. You know, a lot of housing is small landlords and contracts are private between a renter and an owner. So I think, you know, even in that, sometimes people will fall through the cracks.
What is your sense of the federal government's taste for intervening on housing issues right now. We're in a situation where the U.S. House of Representatives is under Democratic control. The administration and the Senate are Republican in composition right now. I mean, what is the likelihood that among all the many, many, many other areas of need right now, from health care to food aid to unemployment, that housing is going to get federal action?
I think there's only so much we can do on the housing front. But I do think there will be bipartisan support for at least using the existing tools that the federal government has to make sure that people don't fall into homelessness or evictions are spurred, because that doesn't help anybody, right? And so especially in this case where, you know, who's going to re-rent and at what rents will that happen? So I think hopefully there will be a general consensus that to keep people housed and to provide some supports will be bipartisan.
Do you think there's anything that we can reimagine about the housing system in this moment?
I mean, I think there are a lot of things, and maybe this is a golden opportunity. I mean, at one, you know, we have programs that help people in need, things like a Section 8 voucher, where you pay 30% of your income, and then the voucher covers the difference. Section 8 has always had a waiting list, but in times of struggle, it helps people because it adjusts their rent to their income. So, you know, I think things like that, if they could be expanded, as people's jobs or incomes come back, then that subsidy would reduce. And there are some legislators that are looking at Section 8-like programs for this crisis. And I think we'll see more innovation coming as well.
Could that include something that changes the balance of payments? Landlords are sometimes reluctant to take part in Section 8 and accept those vouchers because they feel like the government reimbursement isn't enough to make it worth their while.
That's true. I think this crisis and the sheer number of people unemployed and losing income might change that calculation. But that'll be, you know, we'll see in the coming months.
Mark Norman, thank you so much for your time on this. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mark Norman is an associate professor at University of Michigan's Taubman College of Architecture and Urban Planning. His specialty is urban and regional planning. Coming up after the break, this is a time when most of us are staying inside, but there's a new album reminding us of the space and peace that awaits us in the U.S.'s national parks. It's new work from a new music ensemble. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Get outside, the recommendations say. Take solace in nature. That's great advice during the COVID-19 pandemic, but sometimes more easily said than done. Many of us are longing for the wild spaces where we may have spent springs or summers in the past, places we wished we'd visited. There's a new album just released from Grand Valley State University's New Music Ensemble that is inspired by the national parks. Bill Ryan is a professor of composition at GVSU and director of the New Music Ensemble, and he joins us now to talk about the recording. It's called Dawn Chorus. Bill, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you, April. Good to be here.
Hey, before we talk about the music on this record, I just had a personal question for you. How many of the national parks have you visited?
Oh, gosh. The group has been, I'm trying to think. I don't actually know. I probably about 25 parks or so I've been to.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, not bad.
Which ones made the biggest impression on you?
Well, I'm a huge fan of the mountains. So whenever we have headed out west, it's just those grand images, like Glacier National Park was incredible. The Grand Tetons were incredible. Anything with towering mountains is really great.
The experiences of the national parks are so widely varied. Some, like maybe Sleeping Bear Dunes, are welcoming to human visitors, kind of warm and sheltering. And there are some I'm thinking of in the West that are more like lunar landscapes. What kind of range did you and the ensemble hope that this album could reflect?
Exactly what you said. I mean, not only the geography is incredibly diverse, but the composers that we that we commissioned. You know, they're from all around the country, very individual composers, in that they all have very unique approaches to their music. And that's what I was really hoping, that their music, their individual experiences with the environment and with these spaces would help convey that diverseness, that vastness of the parks.
Let's talk about the opening track on the album. It was created by a composer named David Biederbender, and it's called Red Vesper. Will you tell us about his inspiration for this piece?
Yeah, David based this on Capitol Reef National Park. And the really cool thing about this piece is that he asked the ensemble to go and explore the park before we performed. Not only this park, but every park, and take field recorders with us. And so we would record sounds of every park we visited, and then we bring back these field recorders to our concert engineer, who would then play these at designated times during the performance. So as we accumulated sounds, we have this sort of growing audio postcard that accompanies this particular piece. So on the recording, you're hearing actual sounds combined with the ensemble from every park we've performed at so far.
Capitol Reef is one of those lesser known but really, really gorgeous national parks. It's located in Utah, and its landscapes through canyons and mountains, some of them are a little bit reminiscent of the Grand Canyon, but on a much, much smaller scale. And it looks like David said that he chose to call this track Red Vesper because of the deep red glow of the setting sun on the horizon over the park, and the beautiful and iconic red rock formations that are in so many of the parks. It's really, it kind of takes you there.
Yeah, I'm what's very interesting, the experience in preparing for these performances, is that we're in our classroom under fluorescent lights, you know, in spring, and it's really difficult for us to imagine the settings beyond looking online and photographs and things like that. But then when we bring these pieces to these spaces and we're actually performing, you know, surrounded by this stuff, it's quite a remarkable experience from our point of view, from a performance standpoint, let alone the audience also.
You chose to work with some composers that the New Music Ensemble has worked with in the past. Was there anybody on the record who was new?
Let's see. I think, well, actually, Phil Klein, I worked with at a previous school that I was at, commissioned him. And again, one great thing about commissioning these composers is I do a lot of research and track their work through the years. And Phil's someone who I've been really interested in. And there was this opportunity to work with him again. He's very much interested in birds and bird call, and he incorporated that into his music for this album. So that was a cool experience.
There's a piece in here that's by Alexandra Gardner called Vixen, inspired by the Vixen Geyser in Yellowstone National Park. And I love the way that she gave us the sense of time being marked by the geyser's eruptions throughout the piece.
What she did is she came across several recordings of eruptions of this geyser and the eruption cycle from sort of pre-eruption to eruption, and then the reverberation, I guess, of it. And she studied that recording intensely and sort of transcribed the rhythm pattern of that eruption and used that as the foundation for her work, Vixen.
I know this is hard to consider, but do you have a favorite on this album?
No, I have to say I'm very, very pleased and proud of the fact that we have two students, two now alumni, that contributed to this. So Nico Schrader composed a fun piece about an experience running into a bear called Canvas the Bear. Was very young, was out west exploring Yellowstone National Park, and had an experience where he was driving in a Jeep with his grandpa, and he had great memories with that. And then at one point, a bear popped out right in front of them, and you know that made a huge impact on everyone there and on Nico. And he sort of imagined what that bear has been up to after all these years, and composed this as a way of reaching out to that experience and that bear. And then Ashley Stanley, her very first composition that she ever wrote is here. It's called Night Sketches and was based on the skies of Arches National Park. And so that's very satisfying for me. Not only is it are they super interesting pieces, but as their composition professor, that's very satisfying for me as well.
Bill, how would you say your students are doing right now?
My current students are hanging in there. I mean, we finished our classes and we had to adjust the end of our year a little bit. So they are making the best, I think, of the situation, particularly with music and performance, you know, and with our ensemble. We couldn't meet as a group. We did a couple virtual meetings online to you know, give them some activity to do and stay in touch. But we are really hoping that things clear up and that we can resume activity as an ensemble, as larger gatherings are approved, hopefully this fall.
What are you telling them about pursuing their careers at a time when ensemble performance is so very up in the air?
Yeah, well, I just try and get across that this is a temporary situation and that it's also a really great time for them to focus on the kind of nuts and bolts of their craft. And I mean, they're in their homes. They have had a lot of other distractions eliminated, not by choice, but that sounds to me like great opportunity for practice. And again, really diving into their craft. And then when we all emerge from this, they'll be kind of ready to go, 100% excited about the opportunity.
You did not know, of course, when you commissioned these works and recorded them that there would be a pandemic going on, and we'd be so distant from so many of the national parks. How do they sound to you now with that in mind?
Well, it's a little bittersweet. I mean, we were the pipeline for a recording is about, you know, a year out where things are sort of locked into place, and we thought a little bit about, you know, can we delay the release? Is it really appropriate to be coming out with this product and asking people to make purchases and things like that during this time? And on the one hand, but then the other, for just what you said, we have this remarkable experience that we all went through that we want to share with people. And maybe now is an especially relevant time for that we have this kind of survey of incredible land around the country that's represented by all these wonderful composers. And so maybe now it's a perfect time for this. So that's what we went with, and we've gotten some nice feedback on it. And I've heard back from the ensemble and especially the composers that this was a perfect time for this, that they needed this at this moment.
Bill Ryan is director of the Grand Valley State University New Music Ensemble. The new recording is called Dawn Chorus, and it's inspired by the nation's national parks. Bill, it's really good to hear from you, and thanks for this gorgeous record.
Oh, you're welcome, and thank you for having me. Thanks.
As workplaces are trying to think through safe conditions for reopening, there's word of an outbreak of COVID-19 at a Meijer Stores distribution center in Delta Township, just outside of Lansing. 62 people in four counties are now confirmed sick with the virus, all of them with connections to the center. Megan Banta is an enterprise reporter with the Lansing State Journal who's been writing about this. Megan, it's nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Will you tell us about this distribution center in question?
Yeah, so the distribution center is actually kind of a large complex with several buildings that's located off of Crates Road. And the Barry Eaton District Health Department says that many of the buildings have people who have tested positive for COVID-19. We're not sure exactly how many employees have tested positive, and the company isn't answering that. But health departments are reporting 62 cases between four counties.
So can you put that in the context of what the counties nearby have experienced in terms of COVID cases? Does that bump up the average for these counties measurably?
In Eaton County, where there are less cases, the 14 cases might make a little bit more of a dent. In Ingham County, though, there's a pretty significant impact. There are 46 cases. That isn't a lot of the cases overall. There are about 600, according to the last report, but there are quite a few cases concentrated in one zip code in South Lansing. And that's among the refugee population partially. So that is having a pretty major impact on Lansing. The other two counties, Clinton and Jackson, just have one case each. So there's not much of an impact there.
Have you had any information about how these cases were communicated, how the infections happened?
We haven't. Meijer has just told us that they're doing pretty extensive contact tracing. So as they identify one case, they are then going in and testing any of their contacts. We haven't heard that they're doing widespread testing throughout the complex yet. We do know that some of the people in Ingham County passed it to members in their household, though.
And the distribution center is still open and functioning, right?
Correct. It remains open, and the Barry Eaton District Health Department told me that they don't think that any work sites are closed either. Meijer says they've kind of upped sanitation practices, and they're doing social distancing measures, providing masks and things like that. But the center does remain open.
So I was just going to ask about PPE. Do you know if everyone at the facility has access to things like masks and gloves if needed?
Yeah, the company tells us that they do, at least.
Yeah. Megan, have you been able to get a sense of what service area this distribution center provides products for?
I asked that, but I have not gotten that answer. So I'm not sure if they just service locally or if they service a wider region.
What's the company saying about whether any procedures will be changing at the distribution center?
I mean, the statement is pretty short. It's concise. They're just saying that they're kind of keeping up regular communication with team members. They've started doing daily health screenings and temperature checks. But that's been required by local health departments, so that's fairly standard. And everyone is using face masks. They have said, I mean, as far as kind of changing things, anyone who is affected or who might be high risk is being paid through a pay continuation program because they obviously can't report to work if they're infected or if they might be at high risk of, you know, getting sick and dying if they catch the disease.
Would you say this was much of a shock for local health officials?
It didn't seem like it just when Health Officer Linda Vail was talking about it during the press briefing. She didn't seem that surprised. I was kind of surprised by the sheer number of cases. The outbreak at Her Brooks didn't have quite as many cases here locally.
Yeah. Have we heard anything from the company about whether this is going to affect the supply chain to Meijer stores?
You know, the center remains open, but they don't seem to think that it's going to affect the supply chain. Like, you're not suddenly at risk of getting COVID from your groceries at Meijer or anything.
The question is more whether the distribution center can continue to function safely for its employees.
Right. And it seems like health officials think that it can for now, but they are still investigating the outbreak.
Megan Banta with the Lansing State Journal. Megan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Megan had to run because she was chasing another breaking story in Lansing. A judge today dismissed criminal charges against former Michigan State University president Luanna Simon. She presided over part of the time when Dr. Larry Nassar was abusing students at MSU. Keep your eye on developments on this one at michiganradio.org. After the break, Michigan's chief medical executive fills us in on the state's testing capacity and related issues.
As a country, we were so behind when it comes to ramping up testing that I don't think it's a surprise, really, how we fared across the entire country when it comes to the spread of this disease.
That's next on Stateside. Stay tuned. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Over the past 8 weeks, Michigan's relationship with public health has undergone a pretty radical shift. The COVID-19 pandemic has killed more than 4,600 people that we know of and sickened tens of thousands of others. Most businesses across Michigan are offline, and a million-plus children are learning in place as best they can. Dr. Jonae Khaldun's job has changed as well. She is the state's chief medical executive, and she joins us today. Dr. Khaldun, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me back.
The last time we spoke for Stateside purposes, we were at the very onset of the pandemic. How would you say Michigan rates right now compared with other states?
Yeah, so Michigan is certainly improving. We currently rank seventh. The last time I looked yesterday, we ranked seventh as far as the number of cases that we have in the state. And unfortunately, we rank third when it comes to the number of total deaths. But that said, we are seeing a significant decline overall in the number of cases and deaths in the state. So that is positive.
Should we be surprised at the relatively high rates of death and infection in Michigan?
You know, I don't know if surprised is the right word. I think we certainly are concerned. We certainly know that there are a lot of health disparities that exist in the state, and particularly in the Detroit metro area. So it's certainly very concerning. But again, as a country, we were so behind when it comes to ramping up testing that I don't think it's a surprise, really, how we fared across the entire country when it comes to the spread of this disease.
The administration is in the process of trying to figure out which businesses would be safe to reopen and how that might work. Can you tell us a little bit about your criteria?
Absolutely. So it's very complex. So we're looking at epidemiological factors, things like the rate of cases, the rate of rise in cases in different regions, the rate of deaths, the percent of the tests that are done that are testing positive. We're also looking at hospital capacity in the various regions of the state. And especially important is making sure that our public health capacity is what it should be. So making sure we're getting enough tests in various areas of the state, and that once someone tests positive, our local health departments have the capacity to be able to identify those people very quickly and identify their close contacts so that they can appropriately isolate or quarantine as public health would recommend.
Trish Foster, who currently serves as the state's chief operating officer, has said that one of the state's upcoming goals is getting to 30,000 COVID tests per day. Tell us a little bit about why that number is a goal.
So it's really important, especially as we start to reopen the economy, that we can identify anyone who may have the disease as quickly as possible. If you open up and you're not testing enough people, you may have a false sense of security thinking that the disease is not, does not exist. So it's really important that we test. And we're especially prioritizing testing in vulnerable populations. So people who may not have access to a test, people who may have underlying health conditions, those essential workers, those people who will have to come out and work, we are making sure we're prioritizing those individuals and also targeting folks who may be able to spread it to a lot of other people just based on their field of work.
But that number 30,000, is that based on, say, the reopening phases or maybe just what sounds realistic and doable at this time?
So it's based on what a lot of national experts have talked about regarding needing to test roughly 1 to 2% of your population. We are currently looking very closely at that. And again, 30,000 is one next goal, but we actually think if we have the supplies that we may be able to even get higher than that. But again, we really have to focus on our vulnerable populations and making sure as we're reopening the economy, we're also doing appropriate expanded testing.
The Harvard Global Health Institute has a series of recommendations that would suggest Michigan should get closer to 58,000 daily tests before reopening. Could you say why that was not the target that you decided on?
Well, again, it's a moving target, and I'll be honest with you. I think everyone across the entire country, I speak to many state health officers every week, and everyone's kind of trying to figure this out as we move ahead. And again, the 30,000 is a short-term goal. That's for the end of May, right? That doesn't mean that in the fall, we don't need to test even more people. So 30,000 is certainly not the ceiling. It is our next step goal. And you're right, I think we will need to do even more. And as we think about matching these vulnerable populations that I talked to you about, absolutely, we will have to increase our testing beyond 30,000.
Right. Is there data that you'd like to have that you just don't have right now?
Yeah, you know, it's what this pandemic has really shown is that our data systems, our technology systems are not what they need to be. And there's no question that public health, quite frankly, has not been funded across the country appropriately for decades. And so we're seeing that now. I would love to be able to quickly understand the demographics of the people who are being tested. I would love for our various systems between hospitals and the local health department and our state health department and Medicaid and everything else to be able to speak to each other very seamlessly. And so those systems don't always work very well. We're actively trying to address that. But I wish that we all had quicker access to data and that all of our technology systems kind of spoke to each other in a seamless way. And we're working towards that, but that's not where we started off.
Are you recommending that people who do not have symptoms get tested right now?
Yeah, so we have expanded our testing criteria, importantly, again, because we have to expand the number of tests done, especially as we start to reopen the economy. So people who are in these higher risk settings, certainly people living in congregate care facilities, nursing homes, incarcerated, homeless shelters, we are actively looking at expanding testing in those areas, and including people who do not have symptoms.
Yeah. A great many people are trying to make decisions about if they were ordered back to work at this time, would they show up? Would it be safe for them to show up? What would you tell them?
You know, everyone has a right to be very concerned about their health and safety, and certainly we at the state level are as well. But that's why we are slowly dialing up when it comes to reopening the economy and working very closely with employers to make sure they are following best practices when it comes to keeping their employees safe. It includes things like appropriate social distancing, limiting or eliminating people who are congregating in shared spaces, making sure people are wearing masks. So all of those things are really, really important as we work to reopen. And I believe that employees should certainly talk to their employers about what safety measures they have in place to protect their health.
Is there a series of guidelines? I mean, have state health officials been working with those who are regulating workplaces to make sure that employers are enforcing protections for people?
Yes, we're working very hard on that. We're working with our Labor and Economic Opportunity Department. We're speaking a lot with our federal partners regarding this type of guidance, and also working with various employer groups to make sure that we are understanding their business, but also making sure they're implementing the right protective guidelines so that their workers are protected. But again, everyone across the country is trying to build this as we go along. The CDC has not, by and large, put out specific guidelines for every workplace. And so we are actively working on doing that and also looking at other best practices from other states, making sure we're learning from them as well.
If you're just joining us today, we're talking with Dr. Jonae Khaldun. She's the chief medical executive for the state of Michigan. Dr. Khaldun, we're starting to see some reporting on the emergence of something called pediatric multisystem inflammatory syndrome. And hotspots are increasingly concerned about how some of the associated conditions with COVID-19 may be affecting children and young children. Is this something your staff has been tracking?
Yes, we're very concerned about this. Obviously, this is a new virus, and we're all trying to learn how it impacts the human body, how it impacts people of different ages. And so we are currently tracking. We know that there are several investigations going on across the state with patients, pediatric patients in hospitals. And so we continue to ask parents if they think their child is having symptoms, fever, red eyes, red lips. Certainly we want medical providers, pediatricians, emergency departments to be on the lookout for this disease as well. But it is very concerning.
Do you expect that the information that we're just starting to accrue on PMAIS might change some of the decisions that have been made about daycares and maybe schools in the fall as well?
We certainly have to. Again, this is changing by the day. We're learning more and more every day. And certainly it is something that we will have to consider when it comes to thinking about protecting the health of our children. Absolutely.
Yeah. One more thing I wanted to ask about. The Mackinac Center for Public Policy has filed a lawsuit against the Whitmer administration today. Their concern is that the decisions made on reopening businesses, or I guess I should say, on keeping the stay-at-home order in place, have resulted in medical consequences for some Michiganders. I'm not going to ask you about the substance of the lawsuit. And again, this was just newly filed late yesterday. But I did want to ask, can you tell us anything about what procedures are allowable at this point, whether doctors have their own agency to do that, and just what the timetable might be for necessary medical procedures?
Sure. So with the executive order about essential procedures, non-essential procedures, the governor actually did allow physicians to use their own judgment when it comes to determining what is time sensitive and what is not time sensitive. I sent a letter to medical providers a little over a week ago, further clarifying this. So again, physicians should be right now looking at patients who have chronic diseases. We actually put into our executive order that things like cancer screening and testing should actually not be postponed. So that was not in the executive order. In fact, it was removed from, we asked people to actually remove that from their postponement plans. So physicians, and again, I'm a practicing physician, I do believe that physicians should have the authority to be able to determine what is time sensitive for their patients. And again, things that were not time sensitive 6 weeks ago, maybe they are now, and physicians should be talking to their patients about that.
We see the state of New York has just changed its regulations for nursing homes, lifting requirements that nursing homes cannot turn away COVID patients. That's obviously been a difficult issue for rehabilitation centers and nursing homes to have to deal with. Is there any chance that Michigan might follow suit for that?
We're currently looking at that. We have over 20 regional hubs right now in the state that are able to take care of patients with COVID-19. We're making sure they have the appropriate staffing and personal protective equipment to be able to safely care for patients. But again, we will continue to monitor these policies and pivot as necessary, and also, of course, learning from the experiences of other states. We are not out of the woods. And while the numbers are improving, we still see many cases and many deaths every day. I encourage everyone to continue maintaining their social distancing and wearing a mask if you're out in public and not going out and gathering in groups. This is very, very serious. People are losing loved ones. I've lost people that were very important to me. And so it's really important that people continue to take this seriously. We are not out of the woods.
Dr. Khaldun, I'm sorry for your losses, and thank you for the work that you're doing right now.
Thank you for having me on.
Dr. Jonae Khaldun is Michigan's chief medical executive. If there's one person we would most like to deliver a giant quarantine-baked birthday cake to today, it's got to be Michigan's own living legend, Stevie Wonder. He is turning 70. Anne DeLisi, host of Anne DeLisi's Essential Music on WDET, is a huge Motown buff, and she's preparing a Stevie Wonder 70th birthday special. It's going to be airing on WDET this weekend. Anne, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's my pleasure to talk about Stevie Wonder.
There are so many transcendent artists we could talk about who emerged from Motown. What makes Stevie Wonder both unique in the Motown pantheon and as someone who's really kept producing relevant music through the decades?
One of the things was he really was the real deal. You know, he was this kid who was just enormously talented, but still was a kid. And he did things that, you know, given his blindness, you wouldn't expect him to be so adventurous. Yeah, I'm going to go try to ride a bike. I'm going to go jump off of this or climb this tree. And then on top of that, he was so enormously talented. And so he was a kid when he signed to Motown, and he grew up making music. It's just a remarkable story, like a remarkable personal story. And the fact that he really was truly enormous, and of course still is.
They say that heaven is 10 zillion light years away.
What do you see him reflecting in his songwriting that made him stand out even among names like Marvin Gaye and some of the other artists who were working in the city at that time?
So when Stevie Wonder turned 21, his contract with Motown had expired and he was going to re-sign. So they were hoped he would, and he did. But he knew at that time at 21 that he wanted total creative freedom over his work, which he got. And that is when an explosion of creativity happened. And a lot of it dealt with social issues, political issues, but the music was so incredible that people might not have even realized what they were listening to.
Mary wants to be a superwoman. Is that really in her head? But I just want to live each day to love her for what she is.
Like, because the music was so infectious. And so he just really incredible combination of knowing exactly what he wanted, going after it, saying things the way he wanted to say them, and packaging them in some of the most incredible music ever. And it absolutely worked for him. This was all before he was 30 years old.
As a music fan, anytime Stevie Wonder's picture shows up on media feeds or if one of his songs gets played in a news context, there's this sense of terror. Maybe he's sick. Something worse than that. Why is it that Michiganders feel so connected to Stevie Wonder in this way that we worry about him?
Well, he's getting older, and we've seen, unfortunately, so many legendary artists pass. And so, you know, he talked very openly last year about the fact that he needed a kidney transplant. And so I think that people that know that, that's kind of on their mind, is he okay? you know, he was born in Saginaw and grew up in Detroit. And so we feel this connection to somebody like he's our own. He's our own, you know, artist. And we are in this state proud of artists like him. And so Stevie Wonder never records another thing. It's okay. I just like knowing that he's there.
Andalisi hosts Andalisi's Essential Music on WDET. Be sure to spin that radio dial over to DET this Saturday at noon for a Stevie Wonder 70th birthday celebration. I'm April Bear. Thanks for listening. We'll catch up with you Thursday.
Where were you when I needed you last winter? My love.